Welcome, everybody. I'm Dr. Joel Steelman. I'm happy to introduce Dr. Mary Lee today. Dr. Lee will be joining us later in April at the Pestola 2024 Education Meeting. So today we're going to find out a little bit about what Dr. Lee's been up to, and also she's going to scratch the surface in talking about endocrine disruptors. So Dr. Lee, I'm going to turn the floor over to you. Tell me and the audience a little bit about yourself and what you're up to these days.
Sure. Hi. So I am currently an emeritus professor of pediatrics at Sydney Kimmel Medical College, Jefferson University, and at Nemours Children's Health. And until last spring, I served as the chief scientific officer and the physician in chief at Nemours Children's Hospital. But I retired in April to transition to a emeritus status. And since then, I have continued to pursue some of my research in environmental studies, mostly of continuing to finish analyzing the data we've accumulated over a decade and writing up some of the findings with our study team.
That's interesting. So I guess there were two things that I had hoped that we could talk about today. So first of all, endocrine disruptors has been a topic that I think has been certainly talks that I've heard for many years now, probably at least five I can think of. And every time I go to one of the talks, I always am fascinated by what I hear. And certainly I have families that ask, especially when it comes to issues of precocious puberty, about, you know, environmental factors. So tell me a little bit, you know, what do you feel like are some of the key things that you've learned or that you've learned through the research as far as endocrine disruptors and how they impact us on a daily basis?
Sure. So I think that when we think about, my focus in the field of environmental health has been on males, on boys. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it, some of the hormones, the progression of puberty in males and females is different and subject to different influences. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about how endocrine disruptors are affecting pediatric health, particularly in regards to the reproductive system, you need to differentiate effects on boys and on girls. When we think about early puberty in girls, what we're looking at are compounds that have cross-reactivity with the estrogen receptor or act as exogenous estrogens and are stimulating some of the secondary sexual maturation processes. When we look at chemicals and compounds that cause endocrine disruption, by far the majority have estrogenic effects. Mm-hmm. But there are also classes of compounds that have anti-estrogenic effects or androgenic effects. And some of those are probably the ones that are affecting male pubertal development. So in contrast to what we see in girls, in boys, a number of the compounds cause delayed puberty rather than early puberty.
And one of the things that I've heard about and read about too are effects on, genitalia as well. So what are the trends that you all have detected or that research has detected in that area?
So that there was has been a lot of speculation that the genitalia effects that are seen in animals in a number of different species may also be reflected in humans. But as you can imagine, the data for that has been very difficult to determine conclusively. So in you will see genital ambiguity and disturbances in sex differentiation in a number of different species in conjunction with, infertility and sexual behaviors that differ from the norm. In humans, probably the most compelling evidence is some of the work that Shauna Swan has done looking at anogenital distance and how some of the endocrine disruptors have caused some shifts in that. There isn't as much data on other aspects of sexual differentiation that are related directly to exogenous chemicals. You know, we know that if you're highly exposed, you know, certainly it can cause problems, right? Like the children, there's been infants exposed through in utero, through medications or other compounds that have androgenic properties and cause perturbations in the sex differentiation pathways. Usually those are specific high dose exposures, and they have not been as conclusively shown in the environmental studies where you're looking at lower level exposures.
That's very interesting in terms of the effects on puberty. Another area that has intrigued me, and I have to confess I haven't really looked at it recently, is effects on diabetes and obesity. Is that an area that your group or other groups have addressed as well? And is there any new information that's come out in regards to disruptors and effects on diabetes and obesity?
So that's not an area that we've looked at extensively, but we did analyze weight gain and some metabolic hormones in our cohort. So let me go back and explain that the studies that I've been involved in entail a prospective, long-term prospective study of about 500 young Russian boys. We recruited them at age 8 and 9 when they were mostly prepubertal, and then followed them every year with blood work and physical examination, weight, you know, anthropometric measures. And so what we did see is that for some of the dioxins and some of the other compounds, that the children who were exposed at higher levels had a greater odds ratio of being overweight or obese. We did not have enough numbers to specifically look at obesity. But, you know, there are studies in adipocytes, and there are our animal studies suggesting that some of these compounds do shift the formation, the differentiation of adipocytes, and also interfere with metabolic pathways so that there is a greater risk for obesity and metabolic syndrome.
That's interesting. And so, you know, from the research that you and others have done, and I think increased recognition, I mean, I feel like that there's been elevation. Certainly the Endocrine Society comes to mind as, you know, one of the organizations that's in the forefront. So what are some of the things that you see, you know, shifts in policy that's grown out of your research? And what are some of the things that you hope maybe will come out of the work that you've started and that others are continuing?
We're looking at organic chlorines. And so a number of these compounds have our persistent chemicals that have been banned in the European Union first, usually, and then in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so there are a number of compounds that are no longer allowed to be used in household and industrial products. As evidence accumulates on the toxic effects of these compounds, I think that the problem is that as newer plastics are developed, the toxicity hasn't always been evaluated. And so, you know, you may take out phthalates from compounds, but you need to have some sort of plasticizer. And so there may continue to be unrecognized risk with some of the other compounds that are being used. I think that the research in the chemical world is to really try to identify compounds that have a much more specific activity for whatever industrial use they're being produced, and, you know, try to eliminate some of the unknown long-term effects of these compounds. So we've looked at heavy metals as well. And, you know, I think that that's something you've seen in your practice of during the years, the change in the lowest tolerable limit for lead, say, toxicity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have shown in our studies that lead is also associated with delayed puberty. We know it's got neurocognitive effects and effects on growth behavior. And so the levels have really shifted quite a bit over the years, right, from what was deemed unacceptable and requiring therapy. They've really dropped as newer studies have recognized that there's probably no absolute, you know, it's sort of a linear effect, and you can't mm-hmm. just, hey, once you're below 5, you're totally fine. So we do see continuing progress with regulations to try to keep the kids safe.
I agree with that. I think that, you know, it's hard because a lot of these things, I guess, you know, the concerns with pollutants and endocrine disruptors really, you know, one of the chief concerns is that these oftentimes are in the environment for a very long time.
Yes.
So even though mm-hmm. things are banned, you know, recognition right. for lead and gasoline, mm-hmm. leaded paints and things like that, they're still around mm-hmm. and, you mm-hmm. know, it's going to take time. And also the will for people to really work on cleaning up. Mm-hmm. Are there any things do you see that, you know, people that are making laws and making policy are starting to recognize this, and the ideal situation would be preventing something from happening rather than having to react and right. you know, remediate a problem?
You know, so I think that some of the problem is that it is such a highly politicized issue, mm-hmm. and that while we recognize some of the detrimental effects of these compounds, often the effects are long term. So they're not something that can affect individuals right away. You know, mm-hmm. some of the latent or long-term effects of these exposures may not be evident. And that always affects policymaking, right? So if we're saying that exposure now will cause this infant to develop diabetes in 50 years, the impetus for making policies and laws, there isn't as much of a burning platform.
Sure.
And I think that one of the other issues is it's hard to think of a world without chemicals. You know, many mm-hmm. of these chemicals do have very useful purposes. And so we're working away at the most toxic ones and the ones that, you know, could have substitutes that aren't toxic. And so I think that's one way that this is happening, right? People are becoming more aware and understanding the unintended effects of these compounds. For individuals, I think the prevention part is trying to decrease exposure to these chemicals, the pesticides and the compounds. So, you know, doing things like washing fruit and vegetables very well, understanding which ones will tend to hang on to the pesticides. And so mm-hmm. there is a list that's published every year of the dirty dozen, you know, the ones yeah. that are most likely to be contaminated. And therefore, if you are going to try to eat some organic fruits, those are the ones to focus on, whereas other ones you may not worry about as much. So sort of being for an individual and for families, being educated about that and trying to decrease your personal exposure to those by that type of measure, I think is a preventive measure. You know, things like not microwaving in plastic, because we know that plastic is the chemicals, shipped things like that.
And then, so just to wrap up on this particular part, I think one of the things that impresses me is, you know, this, your work and the work of others in your field is worthy from a standpoint of public health, but it's sort of a, if you will, would it be fair to say a high level view?
Yeah, I think it is high level, but it's also epidemiology, right? Mm-hmm. So we're looking at the effects of these compounds on a cohort of mm-hmm. children that maybe shift their pubertal onset by 6 months. Mm-hmm. But it's not enough to be pathologic and bring these kids to attention of endocrinologists. In most cases. So I would say that we do know that there are compounds that children are exposed to in their daily life in the environment and in certain products that can interfere with the endocrine system, but that these effects may be very subtle and may not cause enough perturbation to be considered an abnormal state, but that there are ways that we can decrease exposure to these compounds. And so I would encourage families to try to do that so that these low-level effects are minimized as much as possible.
Okay, thank you. I mean, that's very helpful. So the last little bit here. So you're doing a lot of work with the Pestola 2024, and we really appreciate you coming and being part of that. And I know Dr. Lynch, you know, has nothing but high praise for you. So one of the areas that you're going to do is you're going to moderate our trainees. So I'd like to just sort of hear your thoughts on the future of pediatric endocrine training, kind of as a closing thought, and what you think are maybe some things that people that are entering the field of pediatric endocrinology need to consider or focus on.
So I think that, you know, many of us chose endocrine for our own reasons. One of the things that drew me to endocrinology is that it posed challenges and opportunities to really think about pathophysiology and pathways, and that we can often correct what has gone awry and develop sort of long-term relationships with children. And so that's the clinical aspect of it. I think that what I've seen over the decades is that there are always kind of new insights that inform our practice. So what I see is that individuals now, as they go into medicine and choose subspecialties, are looking for the opportunity to shape their career in a way that matches what they have a passion for, and it thinking about how they want to spend their professional life. And one of the things I would say is that in pediatric endocrinology, that it's not a narrow field. You can still do so many things. And so to really think about the possibilities, I think we still have individuals who are interested and have the skills and the talent and the drive to be, you know, the sort of triple threat of that we talked about in the past. But we have others who just really want to take care of patients. And then we have those who are more interested in the technology side and want to go into industry or, you know, do different aspects. And so what I feel is that choosing endocrine as a fellowship and training in endocrine doesn't limit your career or the scope of what you do, and that you can still shape it in many different ways. And so I want people to understand as they go through their fellowship what fulfills them and what they feel is a pathway that will bring them, you know, that joy and that ongoing mental and emotional stimulation so that they have a really fulfilling career.
Well put. One last question I have. I've had several people in our group discuss the recent poll that came out asking about the duration for endocrine fellowship. So do you have any thoughts on that? You don't have to say I'm for it or against it, but, you know, your thoughts on 2 versus 3 years.
You know, I think that the length of training can be determined by what you want to do with it afterwards, or maybe should be determined. You know, we know that in adult medicine, they feel that 2 years is enough to prepare them to be an endocrinologist. And if you think back to your training, I do think that first, for most people, that you're totally immersed in the clinical world in your first year, and then your second and third year, you're learning different aspects of it. But my thought is you can master those basics in 2 years, but that you need to be open to continuing to learn and to understand when you're encountering a new problem that you didn't have a chance to get exposed to. I think that's going to be true whether you train for 3 years or 2 years. So I do think that the trend is probably going to be in the future that we may end up having both durations of training opportunities for people.
Yeah, I think, my thought is that those that are, passionate and want to do more, say, basic research or just, be more immersed in research will probably stay for a third year. And those perhaps that are more interested in the clinical aspects of care. But one thing I guess I'll say in passing or just in conclusion is that, I'd like most people, I had done 3 years of fellowship, but I mean, I feel like that even in my career, there are still so many things to learn and so much knowledge. So I think, to echo what you have to say, I think that it's lifelong curiosity and lifelong learning in medicine and certainly in pediatric endocrine.
I also think that if you really are planning a career in basic research, you actually need more than the two research years to be competitive for grant funding and to be really become an expert in your area of research. So I was not a science major in college. So I came to medical school with pretty much the minimum classes that you need to go to medical school. And it was not until my fellowship that I decided my residency and looking for a fellowship that I decided I really wanted to engage in the basic research that helped to answer some of the questions we had. And so I did engage in one extra year of training. And I think that if you look at folks who've been able to maintain a really active research career, we don't do a postdoc, and a research fellowship during a clinical fellowship is very different than the postdoc that a PhD is doing after they've had 4 or 5 years of engaging in research to get their PhD. So you really want to make sure you have that foundation and that opportunity to become really knowledgeable and able to succeed in your research career.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And I'm really looking forward to, I'm going to arrive early, so I'm going to be in the back of watching you and Dr. Hale share your knowledge with all the trainees and then listen to your lecture as well. So look forward to seeing you in San Antonio in a few months. So thank you for taking some time to join us today.
Sure. Thanks.